Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means to order. Today we're continuing our hearing on Senate Bill 5523, which is the Oregon Judicial Department budget. Today I had requested that we have some invited testimony, and in working with the department, just so the committee gets an understanding of what the magnitude of what's going on locally and how it's affecting people locally. Nancy Miller is here from the court, as well as Judge Barron from Coos and Curry counties. So would you like to begin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nancy Miller. I'm the Director of the Court Programs and Services Division of the State Court Administrator's Office. And today we really want to take you on a journey. We want to give you a picture of what our court system is looking like now on the local level in real terms as it affects real people in your counties. There are a couple of key themes that we want to stress today. The chair was kind enough to mention yesterday that public safety is a part of what we do, but not all of what we do. We really have three pillars on our courthouse that we'll be handing out to you today. One is the pillar that deals with protecting vulnerable citizens. The second relates to our integral role in public safety. And the third, our role in sustaining business needs. So we've asked our partners and important constituents from each one of those pillars to come and speak with you today. I also asked Judge Barron to follow up a little bit on the presentation that we made to you and the Joint Judiciary Committee about the interconnectedness of the public safety system and how he saw that playing itself out in his court very quickly after the current cuts took place. So we will start with Judge Barron, and then our partners that are here today are Ellen Lowe from the Oregon Food Bank and David Niebel, both also representing the Oregon Law Center to talk about vulnerable citizens, and our public safety partners, Gary Williams, who is the district attorney in Crook County and the president of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, Steve Dole, the president of Crime Victims United, Mark Comstock, representing the Board of Governors of the Oregon State Bar, and our partners in the business community, Alan Tressiter, representing the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and Jim Marquis, representing the Oregon Collectors Association. We also anticipate that we'll have several other partners joining us on Thursday for our public testimony. So we'll start this presentation by giving you a picture of our current situation in the judicial branch. Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee. My name is Rick Barron. I'm the presiding judge of the 15th Judicial District, which is Coos and Curry Counties. They have a population of about 85,000 people. I'm currently president of the Circuit Court Judges Association. I've been a presiding judge for about 21 and a half years and been on the bench for a little over 23 years. I wanted to talk about both the effects, the system effects, and the operational effects on the courts. The first effect that I noticed of the system as a whole was at 8:15 on January 29th when OYA came in, and we had a 13-year-old child in detention because that was the only place we could put him at the time. He'd been in the state hospital, had some severe mental problems, had also other problems, and he was due to be transported up to a bed in the Portland area, and that bed went away on the evening of January 28th. That is what we're seeing constantly now in cases that are coming before the court. We are putting children under the jurisdiction of the Oregon Youth Authority, and that is all we are doing because they are telling us they have no place to put the child, which means we have to then find some other place to put it, including returning the child to a home that may not be the best place to put it in the meantime while we're waiting a space. We've also seen effects where state troopers have come in, a state trooper not appearing for trial, the state having to dismiss, in effect, a drunk driving case because the trooper who was trying to interview and get a new job. We've had requests for postponements where a trooper has to go to an interview to get a new job and request that a trial be reset, which, of course, then puts that trial back on with the other ones. We've also had our shelter area, which is a big impact in our area. We have a 12-bed detention facility and a 16-bed shelter facility. That shelter facility, we've lost half of its beds now, and it may close by the end of June, and that will be a facility that the police use consistently for one arrays, other kids. It's also a facility that is used by our youth investment dollars that we get from the Children Commission on Children and Families. Those are kids sometimes in that program that are used. We use shelter to keep them out of the system, but to give them a respite from their parents to try to work with those to prevent them from being in the system. We have now lost half of those beds, and we're in jeopardy of losing all of those. If we lose those, the police basically will have some kids that they are basically driving around at night with no place to put them. And our detention facility generally runs at full capacity. We have basically a waiting list now for some kids to get into the detention. Just yesterday, there was three or four kids that were supposed to go in, but were full. In fact, we were over capacity. Those kids have to call in to find out when there's space to serve those times. Those have an effect of putting those kids back out in the street, and we're not dealing with those matters. In fact, the other matter that's affecting OYA beds is our cap was cut at least in half at the training school. OYA has asked that we just terminate wardship on some of those kids that they are putting out on the street because they have no other resource for them. We have no other place to deal with them. Some of them, they're turning 18, and they say, well, the adult system will deal with them, which, of course, is not the way to deal with some youth. It's just to put them in the adult system. Some of those people have restitution. We're trying to deal with that factor rather than just having a judgment or trying to deal with those kids and doing that. All of these have affected how we can deal with youth tremendously. On the operational side, for the first 3 weeks of this month, we have deferred processing 326 cases. That's small claims, misdemeanors, felony matters, juvenile matters that we've had to place over that we are not now processing. We have no other courts in Coos County to deal with that. In Curry County, they have a couple of municipal courts that don't handle a lot of those matters. But that is the first 3 weeks. Our district attorney's office has agreed to file most or all non-property or property offenses as violations. Our violations in the first 3 weeks have gone up 50, and our estimate was 80 to 100. It looks like it'll be around 70 cases that will be filed as violations. These are hit-and-run property damage, unauthorized entry to motor vehicle, criminal mischief, criminal trespass are all being treated as violations. We're seeing an increase of those. At the same time, our county and our district, rather, is seeing a decrease in traffic violations because of city, county, and state cuts. We have 12 less police officers on the road, which to me presents a public safety issue, just on people not recognizing that they still need to obey traffic laws, just the coverage if somebody's in an accident in our rural roads, not having somebody respond to those type of things. So that's a public safety issue. What I'm finding, what we haven't found, because our staff in the past, as I'm sure the staff around the state, have been very proud about the fact of how they have helped the court, have moved the court along, and what I haven't experienced that I'm experiencing now is that our staff is not able to process the work, so a case will come up to me and I'm now not getting the current filings on a matter. That did not happen in the past. Our staff is down about 20%. And they're staffing three courtrooms. We have one court. Our county is somewhat unique because we have three court locations, Coquille, North Bend, and Gold Beach. So we have three court locations. But I'm finding that paperwork isn't getting up there. And what that does is it means I take a case under advisement, which I normally could have decided on the bench because obviously I have to take the time to read what everybody submits. That then puts a workload on me that I'm having to get done at the same time trying the cases. Our county and district, I think, have been one of the more current in the state over the years. In 4 years, our time from trial to from filing to trial on average of all the cases was about 120 days from the time of filing to trial when you averaged all the cases in. I am seeing that our cases are now being set out 30 to 60 day more on the criminal docket than from what we had. We have a 4-day work week, and trying to put those cases into a 4-day work week is a problem. In that case, our cases are extending out. The other thing that we've tried to do over the years is try to make sure that most of the cases can be tried in one day. We get it done. We get the juries to the jury so they can decide it. Because there's really no overtime or comp time now, we're stopping at 5 o'clock, and cases that normally would finish in a day are going over to the next day, which delays the start of another case, which as you go along delays the start of a case, and then cases begin to get knocked off the docket. The cases that we are not processing now are being set out because of the four-month period, and we didn't want to set all of them at once, are being set 18 weeks in advance. So those cases that are deferred 18 weeks out. That means that cases that come in near the end of June are not being processed until about October. We didn't want to set all of them July 1st, July 2nd, because that would be an overwhelming amount of work to try to do. One of the things that I find interesting is that the new judges that come in, all the judges that have been on the bench for a while teach different segments. I teach the case management session on how to manage cases and what you should or should not do, and we are doing exactly now what I teach people they shouldn't be doing. We are deferring cases, and we are deferring those cases, and new cases come up on the old cases, and it's merely postponing cases. And when you do that, you create a backlog, and then you have to fight to get out from under that backlog. That has not happened in the past. We've been extremely current. I would like to stay current because that is what processes cases for people, which is who we serve. Whether it's a criminal defense, whether it's a criminal defendants, the state, civil litigants, domestic relations cases, those cases now, at least in our county, we've tried to treat those all the same, tried to process them through the system the same way. That is going to be affected at some point in time because of the 60-day rule. We've not knocked civil cases, domestic cases off the docket. We've tried to handle all those consistently. We've also seen that non-appointment, and this will probably be my last remark, the non-appointment of an attorney does create a problem. There was a man in jail who's been in jail before for various property crimes, and we didn't appoint an attorney for him, and of course he promised to return, and within minutes of being released from jail stole the car, which then meant the police had to go out and try to find him, and unauthorized use of a motor vehicle. If he didn't try to elude the police, he would be back in court and we wouldn't be appointing an attorney on that one, and he would be released again. That's basically the sum of my remarks. I appreciate the opportunity to be here and answer any questions that you had.
Thank you, Your Honor. Questions from the panel? Representative Butler.
Just one quick question for Judge Barron. Judge, with the release from the Oregon Youth Authority of a couple hundred of the miscreants that we've had on the system there, have you seen any of those folks come back with new charges, even Major 11 charges potentially?
Not as yet, and I can't say that I've seen any of those come back, and we'll start to process those kids. Some of them are going to be close to 18, and I haven't seen them in the adult system yet, but we will have some of those kids. Some of the kids that we're terminating wardship on some kids sooner, that I'm sure will be back just from a history of their case, but I can't tell you that I've seen that yet.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask Ellen Lowe and David Niebel to come up and speak next briefly.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Niebel. I work for the Oregon Law Center, which is a private nonprofit statewide group that provides legal representation to low-income people in civil cases around the state. In the legislature, among other things that I do, I advocate for survivors of domestic violence and sexual violence and for low-income and vulnerable seniors. I'm here to support an adequate general fund appropriation for court services to allow vulnerable domestic violence and sexual assault survivors and seniors to have access to courts. Survivors and seniors and their advocates view the courts as an effective source of emergency protection. And I think that the courts are every bit as crucial a part of that system of protecting vulnerable people as law enforcement, as direct service providers are. The courts are a crucial part of that. So I would urge you to keep that in mind when you're considering the appropriation for the court system and to fund it adequately. Thank you.
Thanks, David. Ellen?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe, and I serve as a legislative advocate for the low-income Oregonians who are served by the Oregon Law Center and also the Oregon Food Bank. I usually spend my time this hour in Hearing Room F, where the Human Resources Subcommittee of Ways and Means is hearing all the budgets from the Department of Human Services. And my recollection is that last session, Mr. Chair, you were part of that committee. And so as I listened to the previous testimony, it was so obvious the direct connection between what you were hearing in this committee and what is happening there. They have just finished the beginning hearings, not the work sessions, on the new cluster we call Children, Adults, and Families. And there, as you looked at adoptions, as you looked at efforts for family reunification, for foster care placements, for all of the services to the most fragile families and their children in Oregon, there was mentioned in those hearings, and I see it on your list of protecting vulnerable citizens, the very strong role of the court in terms of providing protection when protection is needed, for providing oversight, for the court-appointed special advocates, for the Citizen Review Board. And so there, and as I listened to the prior testimony and thinking about the Oregon Youth Authority, again, the impact that is going to have on the budgets that are being heard there. And so I urge you to give adequate general fund support so that the courts indeed can be there to serve these very fragile, low-income Oregonians who need our help now so that they don't become part of the system that I'm sure you will also be hearing in this committee or some other kinds of institutional care. And I thank you.
Questions from the committee? Thanks, David.
Thank you.
We have Gary Williams, Steve Dole, and Mark Comstock, I think. Start, Steve.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Dole. I'm president of Crime Victims United of Oregon. I'm sure some of you may ask, what is Steve Dole doing in front of this committee today? We've certainly had our issues with the judiciary in this state, and maybe I'm not usually seen as a supporter, but I want to make this point. While we've had issues about elections, how judges attain and retain their office, and about certain decisions that have come out of the courts, I want to assure you of this. We have the deepest respect for the institution. And we're not here today about elections or court decisions. We're here about this institution, which is our judicial department. We're here to talk about the funding of this department and this system at adequate levels to ensure access for all Oregonians, be they crime victims or criminal defendants. This is really about protecting what's the cornerstone in our democracy, and that is the rule of law. This is integral to public safety. The current crisis that we have in our court system is unprecedented. Already the courts are closed to the public on Fridays. Now, I can tell you there's no good that can come from that, except I will say this as an aside, I have more backlines to judges than I'd ever thought I'd possess in my entire life. Criminal cases are being deferred until the new biennium. We have essentially created a system that tells criminals that it is okay to commit property crimes in this state. We will trust that when we catch you, that you will show back up for your hearing in July. And already defendants are being deferred, going back on the street, and committing new crimes. And I can tell you this, that the criminal justice system is not fly fishing. It should not be catch and release. 22% of the judicial department's workforce has been lost or furloughed. The issue here, again, is not the judges. The issue is the staff to process these cases. The judicial department and institution are over 90% come from general funds. The reductions that have taken place have hit hard. Staff has been laid off, and the entire remaining workforce has had both its pay and hours reduced by 10%. It seems obvious to me that this creates a significant slowdown in case processing. The Chief Justice's maintenance level budget does not fund any new programs. What it does is it allows the courts to process all the case types on a priority list that is in your packets. If the court system is not funded at this level, the Judicial Department will be before the Judiciary Committees asking that the courts be relieved of jurisdiction for certain types of cases. You must ask yourself, do you want to dismantle the court system, this very cornerstone of our democracy? And if we do this, who will do this most important work in upholding the rule of law? And I thank you for your time, and I would take any questions.
Questions at the end of the panel? Yes, that's okay. Gary, do you want to go?
Yes, thank you. Chair Patridge and members of the committee, my name is Gary Williams. I'm representing the people of Crook County as the Crook County District Attorney, and I'm representing prosecutors of Oregon as president of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Our criminal justice system is the system that ensures protection and safety of our citizens, and it is an interdependent system. Citizen reports of crimes go unheard if there aren't police officers to respond or 911 centers. And police investigations and arrests can't be acted upon without adequate forensic laboratory services and without adequate prosecution resources. The most important function of prosecutors, the function that has the most impact on our citizens, and the function that has the most far-reaching effects on our communities and on just public safety every day, that's our charging decision. That's rendered useless if there is no court system to respond to the charges that we make. The local judges' sentencings in criminal cases are dependent on local correctional resources, on jails, on probation officers, on work crews, day reporting centers, jail beds, and of course, state correctional prison beds. If one component in the system is broken, then the whole thing is fouled up. And that's where we are right now. The system is broken, and I would hope that you can do whatever you can to fix it. We can't effectively prosecute cases without a fully functioning court system. And today we don't have a fully functioning court system. You know that the court is not processing many cases. Right now, because of a combination of court operations and indigent defense, courts are not are not processing the majority of cases we file. High visibility cases like ballot measure 11 cases are the ones we hear about, but they are the distinct minority of cases that we as prosecutors are involved in. The majority of our cases are not being processed by the courts right now. To do our jobs, we have to timely prosecute the cases, and that's not happening. Judge Barron just told you about a 4-month delay really turning into maybe a 6 or an 8 month delay, and maybe that's going to turn into a 12 or 18 month delay if these defendants, many of whom are very poor risks to reappear in court, very poor risks to be law-abiding citizens, are being released from jail or not even arrested because the cases aren't being processed. These defendants are being released and will never come back, many of them. Failure to appear rates are expected to exceed 50% in the larger jurisdictions of Oregon. Those cases will never be prosecuted. Defendants won't be prosecuted. They won't be charged and arraigned and convicted in court. They won't pay fines and other assessments. Revenue to the state will be affected. And victims will not be reimbursed for their losses. We have heard over the past month, we have heard on television, we have heard on the radio, we've read in the print media about the effects this is having on us as government workers, as members, officials in the criminal justice system. The ones you don't hear from are the ones who are most adversely affected by this. Steve Dole just told you about them. It's the victims. They are the ones that are suffering from the cutbacks in the state court system. And they are inadequate funding most profoundly affects them. And Oregon citizens deserve better, but especially crime victims deserve much better. Thank you.
Thank you. Mark, were you supposed to go on the next panel?
No, I was happy to go to this panel or the next panel. It makes no difference to me.
Why don't you go ahead? I got you up here.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee, my name is Mark Comstock. I appear before you as a representative of the Oregon State Bar. I sit on the Oregon State Bar Board of Governors, and I also am a civil practitioner. For many years, I practiced with about 18 other lawyers. I want to give you an idea of why the bar urges this committee to recommend and support the Judicial Department's proposal without cuts as it affects the civil practice. There are three reasons that I wanted to highlight. First, an adequately funded independent judiciary is a necessary function of state government. This body certainly enacts laws, and the executive department certainly promulgates regulations and rules. But it is the courts that implement these pronouncements for the citizenry. It is the courts that will implement a regulation that requires the taking of someone's license through injunctive relief. That is an effect that we see. Second, the bar sees this as an access to justice issue. And it's not only access to justice for victims, but it's access to justice for business and for those people suffering from domestic violence. Now, let me just give you an example of how it affects business. The courts are not processing all of the cases that are filed there. Some of these cases are extremely time sensitive. An example,
I practice quite often for creditors. And trust deed foreclosure, that is a non-judicial function. But if there is a question about how the trust deed foreclosure procedure has been implemented by the trustee, and that is an independent person, the only relief is to go for injunctive relief. Now, if there's a trust deed foreclosure sale that occurs on a Friday, I have no access to the courts to be able to have some relief before that money goes outside of the state. It's also access for things like garnishments. You may not know that for garnishments, if there is a question of whether or not the creditor can obtain these funds out of a bank account, the money has to go to the court, and the court is supposed to make a summary determination. Well, that may be an extreme hardship for the debtor who can't pay the rent or whatever it might be, but it's also a hardship for the creditor that doesn't have access to those monies until there is a determination. So we have both the creditors and the debtors at the mercy of scheduling. And as you are well aware, access to scheduling is justice potentially denied. Now, I also wanted to hit the third reason. And the third reason is that this budget is an austere maintenance budget. It's not an expansion. It is just for the adequacy and maintenance of services. And the bar does urge that the committee recommend adequate adequate financing, and that this be funded without cuts. The proposal is important. Now, the bar will continue to advocate for legal services and to provide adequate access to the courts, but the courts have to be open for that access. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Questions for the panel? Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, as we continue to hear the members of the panel and the various folks that are coming forward, it just is impressed upon my mind how very delicately balanced this flywheel is. And any tiny portion of it that gets out of balance creates some real potential difficulty, not just for the court system and the entire judiciary, the victims, the other folks are involved here. And I guess from a meeting that I was fortunate enough to attend with Representative Hansen last evening, cities and counties also come to the table and say, wait a minute, we're not getting the water to the end of the road with our issues as well. If we've got a county that's fortunate enough to be able to get funding for sheriffs through some kind of a serial levy, a serial bond, then all of a sudden the system can't, the district attorneys cannot assimilate those cases. So, or the same with our city police. And so this whole issue, it just is giving rise to more and more questions, and I appreciate the various points of view that are being brought up.
Thanks. Other questions for the panel? Mr. Marquis? Mr. Trester? Charlie, are you going to join them too?
They wanted someone that could talk coherently. I get kind of excited.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Alan Trusteter, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. Our 1,200 members of the Trial Lawyers Association practice in the courts of the state on a daily basis in the civil justice system. And as previous witnesses have told you, reducing the court's budget is truly an access to justice issue. that as people's cases are delayed, it becomes more difficult to put on a case. Records are lost, witnesses go away, it just becomes very difficult. And this really disproportionately affects small businesses, which in business-to-business litigation is quite frankly the majority of the civil justice system. That's what we're talking about overwhelmingly. It's a small business with a contract issue with a supplier. It's a business dispute. That's what makes up the majority of the cases in the civil justice system. As previous witnesses have told you, courts are closed on Friday now throughout the state. Court filings are piled high on the floor because of lack of appropriate staffing. It's just not a very good way to run a railroad. It is something as important as the justice system. And to take up Representative Butler's theme of how these are all interconnected very delicately, we know in the civil justice side that if reductions in the court system continued, that civil cases are going to be pushed further down the line because criminal cases will always go first. It's just a fact of life that courts are going to take criminal cases first, and civil justice cases will be pushed to the back of the agenda. When this session ended 2001, you could reasonably expect a civil case from time of filing to getting before a courtroom and a jury to not take a year in most cases, maybe less than a year. We're now in Multnomah County looking at easily 14 to 16 months, sometimes more. And if this budget is not adequately funded, who knows how long that could be. We could be looking at 2 years before you get your case. We've had an excellent judicial and court system in this state, and it grieves me to see it starting to be taken apart. It is primarily and singularly about access to justice, that people have a right to have their disputes resolved in a timely manner. And so we would urge you very strongly to fund this budget in an adequate and appropriate manner. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, I'm Jim Marquis. I'm representing the Oregon Collectors Association today, which is a statewide association of about 85 collection agencies that are heavy users of our court system. And I'm also representing the Credit Association of Oregon, who is a statewide association made up of retail credit people who work for retail establishments. All of these people are charged with the responsibility for their various companies of going out and attempting to collect legitimate debts that are owed generally by consumers, sometimes by businesses owed to another business. And we find ourselves constantly back to the courts in an effort to file an action, get a judgment to enforce those legitimate debts. We file some of those in circuit court through legal representation from our friends at the bar. And many, many of these actions get filed in small claims where there are no lawyers and the businesses are there on their own. There are about last year, 66,000 small claims cases filed in our court system across Oregon in the small claims departments of circuit courts. There are also some in justice courts, and I appreciated Representative Butler's comment about the interplay between all of this, because it truly is an interrelated process. I don't know how many of those 66,000 cases are filed by businesses attempting to collect debts, and no one really keeps those kinds of records. I would estimate that it's probably close to 50,000 of them. The vast majority of them, I believe, are collection cases of some type that will result in some kind of a money judgment. The jurisdictional limits for small claims court in this state is $5,000. So anything under $5,000 can be brought in small claims. It's a very fast and efficient process for a business. You can go in and get file the action, get the people served, and get this judgment fairly rapidly compared to other alternatives. We have appreciated very much the efficiency of the court system across the state. And I want to say at this point that as the courts have found themselves in difficulty with some $40 to $50 million in cuts since the start of the biennium, Chief Justice Carson and Kingsley Click have bent over backwards to work with our clients in the business community to try to keep moving forward in a way that would allow us to process as many of these cases as we could. At one point, it looked like small claims cases just simply would not be able to go forward. And after many meetings with the courts, we found a way to at least process the default judgments, which that's a huge thing for our clients. Still, if a debtor has a disputed case and requests a hearing, those are not being heard, and they're piling up out there somewhere, and someday they'll have to be heard, and so we're just continuing to fall behind. These cases, if you assumed that the average amount of one of these cases was $2,500 in these little small claims cases, and there are 50,000 of them, that's $125 million a year that would potentially be returned to businesses in our community, in our communities across the state, and has a fairly significant economic impact on where we're at. And I couldn't emphasize enough the importance of being able to continue to do these kinds of cases for my clients. And these kinds of cases, while maybe not important in the overall scheme of things to other people, are very, very important to small businesses. So, again, I want to thank the courts for their cooperation in trying to move forward. I want to urge this subcommittee to try to fund these courts at a level that we can continue to process even these kinds of cases, because sometimes they're the first to fall, and to us the most important. Thank you for your time. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Custer? Mr. Markey. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have statistics? This is a question for both of you, Mr. Trestner and Mr. Markey. We have statistics from other states, what length of time those cases are extending to. Mr. Trestner indicated that civil cases are moving from 12 months to maybe as much as 16 months. Do we know what's happening in Washington or California?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, I don't have those statistics with me, but I can certainly get them for you very quickly.
It would be helpful to know what sure. other states are happening in those states.
Easy to do.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Thank you.
I appreciate the invited testimony today. I certainly hope it helps the committee realize what the scope of, that there's a full scope of services. We talked a little bit yesterday about focusing just on public safety. So any of the panelists that need to go, please feel free to do so. I know everyone's got busy lives and busy things going on. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It wasn't really a question, more of a comment. When I was county commissioner in Multnomah County, I served a couple stints as liaison to the courts. And one of the things that really impressed me with, and that was during Judge Launder's tenure, and we'd meet once a month at the crack of dawn, how incredibly complicated it is in Multnomah County just to bring a trial on. I mean, the prisoners, the defendant has to get there, the sheriff transportation, court security, getting the jurors in the right place at the right time. All of those scheduling problems or scheduling issues, that if any one chunk of that, if there's a chink in it, I can see the whole is going to create a huge amount of problems, even a failure to appear. Not only is justice denied in that case, but it's got to be rescheduled. It's time is allotted, and you got everything but the defendant. And it still doesn't work. So just the amount of complications and the complicated job that they do. It's amazing they do as well as they can.
And the stage control person.
Each time something slips, it means you burn up a lot of resources from one of the other components. If a bail hearing isn't arranged, then somebody stays in jail longer, and that takes space that could be rotated against other prisoners. This is just very frightening to be considering these types of cuts.
Representative Butler.
Can't help but thinking about the, for the want of a nail, her shoe was lost, but, Mr. Chair, and then going back to the original presentation and full ways and means of Chris, the far end, falling off the end of the scale and basically being put in prison at a very, very high cost to the state of Oregon for lack of just having some social workers available for Chris to counsel with early on. So, and that's another piece of this puzzle that we're faced with. And that's why I ask about other states. If other states are in the same problem we are, then not just with regard to the civil, but with regard to the criminal, and then we really end up in a real mess here, a real quandary.
All right. Let's go ahead. Were we going to continue with Susan and the revenue pieces? Okay. Judge Hernandez, welcome. Mr. Adams and Mr. Mazzaro, welcome.
Chair Patridge, committee members, my name is Jim Adams. I'm the court administrator for Jackson County. With the permission of the chair, I'd like to just take a moment and invite my colleagues to introduce themselves.
Good afternoon. My name is Marco Hernandez. I'm the presiding judge from Washington County.
And I'm Ernie Mazzaro. I'm the court administrator in Central Oregon for Deschutes, Jefferson, and Crook counties.
Thank you. Over the next few minutes, we'd like to discuss the impact of the governor's printed budget versus the chief justice's basic maintenance budget, which is the double cylinder handout, page 18 in your information. And basically, the difference between the two budgets represents our ability to continue to process or adjudicate case types 12 through 16. And those case types, civil, probate, property-only domestic relations, small claims, and post-conviction relief, really represent the heart of the two of the three pillars that Nancy Miller mentioned earlier this morning or this afternoon. Specifically, the ability to continue to process those case types allow us to continue to protect children, families, and our most vulnerable citizens, as well as the ability to support and maintain business or sustain business. In terms of the first pillar, the protection of children and family members necessitates the ability to legally absolve failed marriages where only property issues are at stake. A bit of background might be helpful in putting this into context. Generally, those types of litigants fall within two categories, those of marriages between 0 and 5 years and those of marriages in excess of 20 years. And it's important to be able to not only bring those relationships to closure, but for the 0 to 5 year marriage category, oftentimes it's important to allow those individuals to go on and establish permanent and new unions, as well as to have a fair and equitable distribution of the assets, because oftentimes children are going to result from those later unions. In the latter category of people who have been married 20 plus years, it's critical to have the equitable distribution of assets, because simply that comes down to many of those are some of our most vulnerable citizens. The second piece I wanted to touch on in terms of probate services is that frequently within our most vulnerable communities, we have individuals who are either there's a guardian or a conservator overseeing the protection of that individual. And often in those relationships, they also serve in the capacity of trustee over a probate matter. The ability to continue to provide probate services allows the court to the ability to monitor the distribution and the oversight of those assets to protect those most vulnerable people. Regarding the second pillar of establishing supports for business, all those categories of 12 through 15 provide a high level of resolution of monetary disputes, legal safeguards governing the conduct of both business and government, as well as the collection of taxes, the ability to collect taxes, and process civil forfeitures. In closing, I believe that each of these case categories are fundamental for the court to preserve the basic quality of life that we as Oregonians share. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Judge Hernandez.
Thank you, and thank you for the opportunity to speak with all of you. I have to say that 20 years ago in 1983, I was working for the Senate as a page delivering notes to each of you, and I never dreamed 20 years ago that I would be in front of you imploring you to fund our justice system at an adequate level. Nonetheless, here I am, and I will proceed apace. In Washington County, I became the presiding judge with a great deal of enthusiasm in January, not this year, but the year before. And when I became the presiding judge, I was aware that there were budget shortfalls on the horizon and things were going to have to change. And people were asking me, why do you want this job, knowing that that's going to occur? And I viewed it as a challenge. What happened in Washington County when the first special session met was that we lost around 20% of our population as far as our staff goes. And that meant that we lost all of our court reporters. We lost our release officers who used to help us make decisions about who to release and who not to release. And we lost a variety of other staff throughout our system that helped us basically process paperwork. Again, I looked at it and I said, we can deal with this. We can survive. And we were able, notwithstanding the cuts that we took, to continue to process civil cases in a way that we hadn't processed them before. In fact, we gained efficiencies and we were processing more civil cases than we had before. Our current situation is that our civil caseload is about at a year, and it's in fact getting better right now, and it will continue to get better until July. Our criminal caseload was being processed in a way that was more efficient than before because, notwithstanding our system was not as good, we couldn't keep as good a record because we lost all of our reporters, and we couldn't make as good of release decisions because we lost our release officers. Just through some organizational things that we undertook, we were able to process criminal cases in a way that was more efficient than we had previously done. I was hopeful that we would be processing domestic relations cases in a more efficient way. That is my project beginning in July of 2003 and going into the next biennium, and that was my next area of focus. I was also planning on improving the processing of our juvenile cases by assigning a single judge to take on juvenile cases. A one-judge system for juveniles seems to work the best because then the same juvenile appears before the same judge and they establish a history rapport and are better able to serve that particular population. Then what happened is the fifth special session took a turn and sent us into another tailspin and kind of put everything and all my plans on hold. Nonetheless, we continued to process certain categories of cases. Obviously, you know that we're not processing small claims and non-person misdemeanors, and certain other felonies were not being processed as a result of the cuts that indigent defense took. Those have been delayed and are being put on into July's docket. Now, you heard from another presiding judge their plan is to simply take those cases day for day and lay them out day for day out into the future. That wasn't my plan. My plan is to take every one of those cases and put them on my docket personally. 100 cases a day I'm planning on processing beginning in July and going until I can't take it anymore. I don't know how long I will last, but 100 cases a day are going to be on my personal docket until I can get through that great bubble that we have created as a result of not processing those cases. That plan and bubble depends upon the court system being adequately funded. If it is not adequately funded, as the chief has suggested, that maintenance level, and I think that level is what occurred after the first cut, and after the first special session, that's what we're after. If that doesn't occur, then what happens is I cannot resolve that bubble in July. Because what happens is we have a whole other lump of cases that are not going to get processed, and at some point we have to do something with those cases. So what's going to happen in July, if it is adequately funded, is I will do 100 cases a day. I will shrink that bubble down to a manageable size. There'll be an echo bubble in the fall, but I anticipate by the time a year goes by, I will have had that big bubble of cases managed. If we don't get the chief's level, that bubble will continue to grow, and we'll never get a handle or our arms around it. It will just simply continue to grow and continue to grow and continue to grow. I implore you to fund this system of justice adequately. I can assure you that everybody will work very, very hard in Washington County to make sure that we make do with what you give us. But it has to be at a certain level. Our backs are to the wall, and we have no other place to go. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Questions? Representative Butler.
I just wanted to ask Judge Hernandez, Your Honor, what of mediation and alternative dispute resolution when you get this backlog of cases? Are we referring or seeing more resolution through alternative dispute resolution and mediation?
On the small claims level, most of our cases were resolved through mediation and through mediation. On the domestic relations level, many cases are resolved through mediation. On the civil level, those cases that go through mandatory arbitration, a great number of those are resolved through alternative dispute resolution, which happens to be arbitration on the civil level. On our civil caseload, historically, we weren't where we are now. Right now, I am happy where we are. We are at a 9 month to 1 year case setting. In fact, what happens on the civil level is we ask the parties, you tell us when you want to try your case, it has to be within a year. That's when that case goes to trial. There's going to be no recess. They pick their own date. We're current, but all that goes away if we don't get funded adequately. We will lose everything that we have gained over the last year.
But do you see a greater use of the mediation and alternative dispute, recognizing that the cases could string out now for rather than 9 months, could string out to 18 months or 20 months?
I anticipate that that will occur, that there'll be more of that occurring. But it's really hard for me to predict exactly how it will manifest itself. I'm not sure what number or percentage of cases that will occur. I did bring for you the number of cases that are effective. Small claims cases in Washington County, there's about 5,000 of them. Probate cases, there's about 1,000 of those. Civil cases, there's about 4,350 of those. And divorce cases, there's 3,800 of those. Now, on the divorce cases, if you look from the chief's list, it says that the property only domestic relations cases would be affected. That's about half of that 3,800 number. So that half of those divorce cases would not be processed. I anticipate many of those would be trying to figure out any way to get divorced. They want to be separated. They want to unhinge. And we're telling them, sorry, you can't do it through the court system. We're not processing those cases. They'll have to be looking for other ways to do that. And I don't know that there's other resources available that can absorb that number of cases.
Chair Patridge, Representative Butler, many of Oregon courts have exhaustive mediation programs. The point I like, and for example, the small claims programs in Jackson County, we refer all contested small claims hearings to our local community dispute resolution center where mandatory mediation occurs. Those cases that cannot settle then come back to the court and are not heard by judges, but elected judges, but are heard by volunteer pro bono pro se attorneys who volunteer their time and hear those cases so that we can be freed up to conduct civil settlement conferences. But from a staff perspective, I think it's important to get on the record that actually creates an additional step and becomes workload intensive for staff. And it's at the heart of the Judicial Department's critical workload staffing issues that exacerbate that issue. Had not the Chief Justice issued the order for discontinuance of small claims cases and non-person misdemeanors, I can assure you Jackson County would have had to discontinue our small claims mediation program simply because we no longer have the staff necessary to do that additional workload.
We've got to pick up the file.
move it from area to area and
monitor compliance
and put it in the computer.
Mr. Chair, didn't 1997 legislature approve some additional fees to accommodate the additional costs for mediation and alternative dispute?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think what you are thinking of is an increase in the filing fee surcharge,
yes.
But
mm-hmm.
that went to the Dispute Resolution Commission, not
That's
to the courts.
Okay. Thank you.
That's in general government.
Okay. No, actually.
Do we have it here?
Oh, okay.
All right. Back. All right.
For the record, I'm Ernie Masrall, the court administrator in Deschutes, Jefferson, and Crook counties. I just have one major point I'd like to make, and it's kind of a follow-up or an expansion of what Gary Williams talked about, the prosecutor, the district attorney for Crook County.
And Mr. Masrall, didn't you receive some kind of award recently in the last 2 years or something like that?
Mr. Chair, that was awful nice of you bringing that up. Yes, I did. I received the... I really received two awards, and Jim Adams, my colleague, also received one. I received the Distinguished Service Award out of the National Center for State Courts, which is given to one trial court administrator a year in the nation, and it had to do with family law, friendly court type issues. And the Chief Justice just recently bestowed on myself and also Jim Adams a Supreme Court Award for our work helping the state court system in a lot of different areas.
Well, would it be safe to say that you're a national innovator and leader in this particular area? You don't have to answer that question.
Mr. Chair,
I could ask Jim if that's true, but, and I know what his answer would be, and the chief is shaking his head, yes. So. Now that I've hopefully embarrassed you a little bit, but I do want to say that we do have great innovators in Oregon, and I appreciate both you and Jim's work.
That's awful nice of you, Mr. Chair. building a little bit on what Gary Williams had to say regarding timely disposition of cases and what it does to them. You know, that's a fundamental underpinning of court administration, is a timely resolution of disputes. And if that doesn't occur, several things happen. And let me just kind of recite some of the issues that we get faced with if we can't move cases through the court system. Memories fade. Witnesses are lost. Businesses suffer. Defendants flee. Victims can't move on. I've seen evidence misplaced to where cases couldn't proceed when I worked in the criminal courts in Houston. We were so backlogged. Having cases linger in the system is totally counter to our whole fundamental philosophy of court administration. You know, my hope is that justice is no longer delayed for anyone in state court systems, and we need your help to make that happen. Thank you.
Yep. All right. Questions for the panel? All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate you being here today.
Thank you.
Susan, do you want to go ahead and finish up on the revenue piece? And Doug, you want to join her?
Mr. Chair, I thought I'd lost him.
You thought you'd lost him?
I thought he was returning tomorrow, so I'm glad you mentioned him. I didn't see you come in.
I was going to make apologies for him.
I guess I put words in your mouth yesterday. I'm certainly capable of doing it again.
Just put money in our budget.
That would be someone else's decision. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Susan Klosterman. I'm the Deputy State Court Administrator for Business Operations. And Doug Gray is here again today also, and Doug is a trial court administrator in the Multnomah Circuit Court. And I don't know how much time you want to spend on this, and I guess I'll be brief. I know we have a lot to cover in the next couple of days, too, but I certainly would invite any of you who have questions about our revenues or our collections programs to call, and we'd be happy to meet with you individually because I know there's a lot of interest in that subject. We covered a little bit of this a few weeks ago as we talked about the criminal fines and assessment account revenue forecast, and then a little bit again yesterday. We got briefly through the first few pages, so I will just say that the circuit courts collect a significant from our viewpoint anyway, probably not in the grand scheme of things, but millions of dollars of monies each year that are transferred for the most part to other state and local governments. On page 2 of the revenue and collections handout, you'll see the history over time and the growth of those revenues. You'll also recollect yesterday we talked about the revenue forecast for the 03-05 biennium, which is the $184.9 million, which would be our estimate of the revenues collected next biennium based on a funding level to process all of the case types that we currently do process. We had talked and provided with the March forecast to the Office of Economic Analysis, a forecast that would reflect a governor's balanced budget level of funding and kind of a delay in processing the case types based on the priority listing that you have in your packet. And our estimate would be a reduction to $156.8 million or $28 million reduction. The page 3 has a pie chart which shows who gets the money, the $156.8 million. You'll see that the largest single piece goes to the criminal fines and assessment account. The distribution of that by the Department of Revenue is based on current law, which is determined by the legislature. On page 4, you'll see just a comparison of, over time, the monies collected by the courts compared to the general fund budget for court operations, and that has grown over time, and it would even have grown more without the changes that took place last session and moved some of our what had been general fund revenue administration staff to be funded from the revenue stream. So we are showing here just the monies that we pass on to others compared to our general funds expenditures, but even at that, the rate is constant compared to last year. To move on a little bit about our collections program, we do have policies in place for the statewide court system. Each court also has policies that work in their community at the court level. On page 6, we've made a list over time of the different legislation, the authorities we have to improve and help our collections program. Started in the early days with authority to accept credit cards, along the way to develop partnerships with the Department of Revenue and also with private collection agencies. We also, like the executive branch of government, report our delinquent accounts receivables to the Legislative Fiscal Office. And also, I should say, we work closely with the Department of Administrative Services and with the other collection, primary largest collecting agencies in the executive branch on strategic planning for collections and accounts receivable, and also on their accounts receivable core committee. On page 8, we describe a bit about our automated accounts receivable management system. Once our receivables are entered into this system, the system pretty much takes over and the collections process is very automatic. If a person or debtor's late in their payment, the system will send out a demand letter depending on the action set up at the local court level, perhaps a second. The driver's license can be sanctioned through that process. And at one point in time, usually 30 to 45 days after the debt is delinquent, the account will be turned over to the Department of Revenue, where they have 26 staff dedicated to the court collections. And we have a nightly update that goes back and forth, so they're a serious partner in our collections effort. As are private collection agencies. We have worked with private collection agencies since the mid-90s, and we have just last year put that same automated system in place with private collection agencies.
Representative Butler, I don't know whether this question is for Ms. Klosterman or for LFO staff, but the 20 positions at the Department of Revenue for collection purposes, is that a Department of Revenue funding issue, or is that a Department of Justice funding issue?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that.
Ms. Mr. Chairman and Representative Butler, those are staff at the Department of Revenue, and their funding sources from the monies they collect. So they take 13% off the top of the monies they the delinquent debt that we turn over to them, and that's how they pay for the staff there.
Has it always been 13% following, Mr. Chairman?
It's been 13%, but they do a reconciliation of their actual costs and give us a rebate every biennium, so I think actually it's around 10% or more. 10% or so when they do the reconciliation every 2 years.
And do we have any definition of efficiency over there in relationship to other Department of Revenue employees as to what, because we have other folks collecting various kinds of things, tobacco, alcohol, and other kinds of revenues. Do we know what their efficiency level is?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, I don't have any comparisons within the Department of Revenue, and it's probably different kinds of programs, too, but that would be a question we could explore with them. We do have some graphics here that show, from our perspective, their performance in collecting our debt over time.
Perhaps that's something that you could encourage those folks to bring forward. Representative Patridge will also hear that in general government as well.
Why don't we ask revenue for performance, and then also what the differences in case type. What's the predominant amount of debt? Can you give us a breakdown of what your debt looks like? I would say it's probably mostly violations. Can you break it down into felonies, violations, misdemeanors, that kind of stuff? Parking tickets.
Did you want to speak to that?
Oh. You don't have to tell me now.
He's whispering.
You understand what I'm asking? I'm asking what your mix is of your debt that's out there being collected. That's all I needed. I'm not sure.
Sure, we can provide that.
And then, Mr. Chair, I think that's something that probably needs to be followed up on. I don't know that just because they happen to be the Department of Revenue, that necessarily makes them the best collectors around.
Oh, I don't think so.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Butler, to get at your question about Department of Revenue performance and collections rate, on page 10, you can see over time the dollars and the comparison to the dollars collected to the amounts that we have referred to the Department of Revenue. And their most recent collection rate is 11%, and we do compare that to national statistics on a first placement of delinquent debt. And that is, I'm looking for the number.
So that's on page 10.
Yes, it's
second,
on page
bottom
10.
Of second paragraph with the
national asterisk. Average is 10.8%, so they're right in the ballpark.
And this is Mr. Marquis' National Association.
I would guess that he participates with them, yes.
Okay. What's that?
I would guess that he is an active participant in that association, yes. Moving on to page 11, Mr. Chair, that shows the history of the Department of Revenue Collections history, and you can kind of see how it's grown. In 1993-94 is when we had the legislation that began our partnership with them, and in 96-97, another big jump is when we implemented the automated system. So it's been increasing ever since. So those efforts have made some improvements in the monies collected.
Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, we looked at this before, and I'm looking at it again today, and I'm thinking, my gosh, with this kind of authority, why is it we can't collect more money? Can you help me to understand that? Because you give me the authority to garnish and have access to their income tax and take their kicker and the ability to you know, go after tax refunds, and I have a credit card system set up above. Why is it that we can't do a better job of collecting that?
And that's a tough question, Mr. Chair and Senator George. I think we can boil it down in my mind, and Doug can elaborate on this. He certainly has a lot of experience in this area. The nature of our debtors, I think, is one important point. The accounts receivable aren't primarily the civil filings. Those are monies paid up front, but it's those accounts that are after judgment, primarily criminal, and I think a lot of these debtors are, probably institutionalized. So one, I think, is the nature of the debtor, and then also criminal judgments are good for 20 years, so we take very seriously an administrative write-off of accounts, so we don't really do that very often because the judgment is in effect for 20 years, and so we carry, and I think the philosophy is, what can it hurt? I mean, it may be that someone comes into some money for one reason or another and there will be ready to collect it. So other than the perception that we have this huge amount of uncollectible debt, I think we think we don't want to give up the ghost. But Doug may have something to add.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I agree with Susan's assessment. We're not permitted to do any screening on about 90% of our debtors. We take them as they come through the court system, and we're simply assigned to collect the obligations that have been imposed. And most of these people are in probably the most unstable point of their lives. We do, however, hold these judgments. We do anticipate that at some point we may be able to collect on them, and we do continue to try to collect on them. And there is a fairly regular stream of title companies coming in or individuals coming in trying to get loans through banks that are paying off criminal obligations many years later. So we certainly don't give up the ghost on these debts. We stay after them. But at the time of the criminal proceedings, very often these individuals are not in any shape. They're drug dependent. They're in trouble with they're in jail or on probation. They're out of work. And we simply have to book the account receivable and hope for the best. Now, I will say that on various types, for instance, on parking violations in Portland, we have about a 70% collection rate. It's a much different cross-section of the population we're dealing with. On traffic violations, you also have a much higher collection rate. But on criminal, it's very hard, tough going to get these people in a situation where they have assets that you can get to.
Does the automated system allow you then to hold them basically online and watching for any revenue flow in the future? Is that part of what that does, or have I...
Mr. Chair, Senator George, the automated system doesn't allow you to sort of hold them looking for revenue, but what it does allow you to do is to keep that judgment in the judgment lien docket so that it is available to be enforced against any property the person may have. Often we will send cases to the Department of Revenue, and they may return them after a year as uncollectible, and then we'll send them out to the third-party collection agency we work with. They will then try to collect them. And if there's still nothing that returned on both of those collection efforts, we will still hold the account and hold it as a non-current receivable and go back to it from time to time just to see if anything has changed.
Mr. Chair, down in General Government, House General Government, we had the first committee hearing on a bill today, which would assist in not necessarily the collection, but making sure that any of the folks that had privileged licenses in the state of Oregon, including such things as driver's licenses or the other kinds of licenses to businesses, construction contractors, chiropractors, or physicians, or those kinds of things that are issued by the state, we have more cooperation between the Department of Revenue and the agency issuing that license, so that we can make certain that those folks that are applying for those privileged licenses are square with the Department of Revenue. I realize that doesn't necessarily collect, but it does say that the Department of Revenue has at least one additional shot at those folks to help collect them if the bill passes by committee.
Go ahead, Susan. Chair, on page 12 is an interesting graph that probably requires a little explanation. It shows our history with a private collection agency. And as I think I mentioned, just last year we put an automated system in place. Prior to that time, it had been a manual referral system with a private collection agency. So that explains some of the jump in the last year. And I think that will improve even more in years to come because it was really implemented mid-year. Also, we have a contract with a new private collection agency that has national court collection experience, and they have a lot of good and new ideas for change, and we're looking forward to working with them and expecting that our revenues will increase over time. I should have also mentioned that 73% of our receivables have been referred to either Department of Revenue or a private collection agency for referral. On the last page, I wanted to mention, well, I guess I should mention three things. One is that we do have an accounting change reflected in our budget document. Up until now, we have been recording Department of Revenue and private collection agency costs net of revenue, and the budget document includes those now as expenditures, and that's a new requirement with the Oregon Accounting Manual. So that is not a new money or a change in the cost. It just reflects a change in accounting and budgeting practice, and that's a part of our current, our Chief Justice's operating level budget. And we also have two policy packages that we'd like to mention, and one is we're requesting collections manager position to be funded from the revenue stream. With the new systems and the changes from Senate Bill 70 and with the new private collection agency, we have been spending a lot more of our staff time and see a lot of potential working to improve collections and policies within our system, but also we've worked with the Attorney General to delegate more authority to the private collection agency so they can do some things like garnishments, which they don't currently have the authority by contract to do. So we think that would boost collections considerably. And then I'll let ask Doug to talk about his package, which is the last one on page 15.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the trial court operations policy option package number 102 is a request that the 10 limited duration positions that were created as a part of Senate Bill 70 last session be retained and be converted to permanent status. These are other funded positions, and these have provided us the staff to put together the collections program that we now have in Multnomah County. I want to emphasize that while we're getting the backlog of cases into the collection system, that collections itself is incredibly human resource intensive, because every time you refer an account out to collection, you have a phone call or a letter back that has to be responded to and has to be handled. And we really desperately need to have the staff resources to do that. If they don't get serviced at the court level and the individual isn't satisfied that they've exhausted all of their appeals to the court, which is what the staff have to work through them on, then they begin to accept the collection action. And then you begin to develop a relationship with the debtor where they understand they have a debt to pay and an ongoing responsibility to do it. The other part of this is just ongoing servicing of accounts and mailing of notices of debts due. We have a special restitution collection program. We have one person managing all of the restitution cases in our collection system, and that person actually does monthly billings to the defendants of their restitution amounts and the rest of their obligations that are owed, and we monitor those cases on a month-to-month basis. This is both a commitment to victims of crime to try and make sure we were doing everything possible to collect the money, and also has served for us as a pilot as to what kinds of services we can provide to try and stimulate increased payments back from the clients that we have for the collections department. All of this has been possible with the positions that were created last session, and we would request very strongly that these positions be continued as other funded positions allocated to Multnomah County Circuit Court.
Maybe talk a little bit about the ARM system and the implementation. Mm-hmm. With the technological fix, has that saved us court staff? Have we been able to optimize? I mean, I know we lost a huge bunch of staff, but did we lose part of the collection staff as a result of the fact that we can do a lot of the things through ARMS now? Can you address that issue? Or Doug, if you don't want
to. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the ARMS system allows you to take and create an account with an individual, allocate multiple cases into that account, and to set schemes that are going to take place with that account. generates a notice of collection action, generates a letter of payments past due, and ultimately will make an automated referral to an outside collection source, either Department of Revenue or a third-party collection agency. And that is tremendously helpful, because I think that collections is a combination of staff skills, learned staff skills in the collection discipline, and a strong system to support it. And ARMS does give us a very strong system to support those cases. It just doesn't remove the need to have some staff, though, there to work the cases, to work the new cases, and to respond to the inquiries that come in. But the accounts receivable management system, as you've seen from the revenue jump, has made tremendous, it's a tremendous tool for us, and certainly the work we've done in the interim with the staff that we were given last session would not have been possible without ARMS. It's an effective, solid, stable system for the trial courts.
Is it possible to centralize your collections fees? I mean, I know you're going to have to deal with people at each of the circuit courts to some degree to deal with some sort of collections as people come in and make payment plans or do those kinds of things. I understand that you'll have to do that, but in terms of those people who are working with the ARMS system and doing collections, is it possible to gain some efficiencies of scale? Carl should just make it, spit it all out right there, here in Salem, make it happen.
Mr. Chair, I think what's happening in the local courts is they're recording the monetary obligations into the system. So I don't think that work would go away. And centrally, we do work with the private collection agencies and contract management and with the Department of Revenue, but so do the local courts. And I think that...
Does that not happen when they enter a judgment anyway? I mean, does the money piece not get in the system as we're entering a judgment in the system? That's why I'm asking.
Mr. Chair.
Court stack, I mean, if it's being entered, they're printing out the judgment, so it's being entered in the system. The system's generating a copy of the judgment. I understand that you need at least some collections people to deal with people there locally from county to county, but we're in a tough situation, budget-wise. And so my question is, of the, what do we have, 27 judicial districts?
Right.
Of the 27 judicial districts, do we need one person in every county doing collections, handling the paperwork, stuffing the envelope, sending it out, doing that stuff? Or can you do that from, here in Salem?
Or better yet, from our prison.
Not with collections, so. Representative Butler. If you'd like to turn your Social Security number over to those guys at the state prison,
okay.
When you have the corrections budget, I'd be happy to give them to you.
Point well taken.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that there's a certain amount of the collections work that is always going to be uniquely local, particularly where you have ongoing obligations of the defendant in the local court, for instance, on probation and coordinating with judges on what payment plans should be and those types of cases. Certain high-volume kinds of things may lend themselves to being more centralized than they are now. But I think that for the vast majority, maybe, of the misdemeanors and felonies, that still would probably need to remain a fairly local process. What does happen as cases go up into the Department of Revenue is the Department of Revenue, in fact, becomes that central clearinghouse, and you still have a fairly large volume of contacts coming back to the court because of the need for additional information that may not be available in OGIN or from the ARM system for the Department of Revenue. So there is a potential, I think, for some centralization, maybe in the violations area especially, but it would probably be very difficult to do in felonies and misdemeanors.
I'd like to take a look to at least see where we're at and what kind of staff we've allocated FTE-wise across the state doing collections. I know in many courts they're probably doing collections and, verification or some other piece, so I know that in and of itself it's not a simple wave of the hand fix, but I would be interested in the court getting back to us on if there's some ability to do some of that centrally. I wish not to offend, lest not to offend the presiding judges and trial court administrators in the 27 judicial districts in the state, but by the same token, if we can centralize some of those functions, Carl can get the computers just kicking it out, we'll save some money. Representative Hanser.
Thank you. I don't want to sound like the voice of total voice of gloom, but it would seem to me that your projections are probably a little high if we have other cutbacks in parole, probation, supervision, working health plan, these type things. This is already a pretty vulnerable population that you're trying to wring money out of. And then if we're cutting back basic services to them in terms of helping them get find jobs, this put their life back together. It seems to me you can't get blood out of a turnip, and especially if the turnip's not working. So I think we might. I would think these numbers are pretty fragile.
Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, this is a comment, and that is, I've always been concerned, and maybe it's just my tough law and order kind of position, that anybody, if I were a judge and disobeyed, my court orders and restraining orders and didn't pay their doggone fines, that there is a real message that's being sent out here, the fact we don't enforce this. And I think it is part of the whole process, that we collect these monies on time and that people get, a little education going here that, in fact, when you violate law and you're held accountable by court, you will, in fact, pay. So I hope we can do something here to make sure that we do everything we can to send that message that you owe it, you're going to pay it.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, if I could just respond briefly. I will assure you that judges do in fact, impose sanctions for failure to pay on a fairly regular basis in terms of probation violations. That often doesn't bring in any more money, but they may spend a couple of days in jail or have some other conditions of their probation change to try to stimulate the flow of dollars, or a substantial jail threat may be used to try and convince the individuals they really do need to come up with the money. I think judges are very concerned about collecting the money and do try to use their authority to maximize the amount of revenue they're able to generate from these cases.
I just had a question of fiscal. On package 102, this extra $900,000 is the conversion cost from 10 limited duration positions to permanent status. What's the total cost of this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is that should be the total cost. They're limited duration. They aren't in the budget.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So
For 2 years, for 10 employees,
that $900,000.
Okay.
$907,000.
Thank you.
Susan, anything? Doug? Any further questions for Susan and Doug?
Mr. Chair, yesterday Senator Devlin had asked for some additional information, and I'll leave that with Robin, if that's okay.
Senator Devlin has his spare time where we've been. There'll be a quiz tomorrow. So. Doug, can you add a side comment? Can you explain to the committee why we do my understanding of the Multnomah courts, and Representative Hanson probably can fill in on this, but we don't do the parking violations and those kinds of things. Multnomah County doesn't, and correct me if I'm wrong, Multnomah County doesn't have a municipal court, and they're prohibited by statute, I think, is my understanding from having a municipal court. We processed their parking tickets and everything else. I think part of the reason was is there was some scandal, I don't know how many years ago.
I wasn't involved.
We can get you a lawyer. There's a few of them in this room.
Must have been more than 50 years, though.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the history on how Multnomah County Circuit Court came to be the municipal court for the city of Portland goes back to the early 1970s. The city of Portland had traditionally run a municipal court, and they simply could not afford to fund it and pay indigent defense attorneys to provide services to the criminal defendants. it was causing an enormous strain on the city's ability to keep the court going. In fact, as we've gone through the current round of planning, people have come up who worked in the former municipal court in the early 1970s, like 1970, 69 and 70, and said that they had a stamp that they used whenever they ran out of indigent defense money that was continued indefinitely. And they would simply stamp files continued indefinitely after first appearance, and those would go to the file room and never be touched again.
Pulled out that stamp.
We have not pulled out that stamp. To assist the city, the county at that time agreed to integrate the municipal court into the district court, which at that time was county funded. The state only paid the judicial salaries for district court judges. And the district attorney's office then took over the prosecuting responsibilities. The jail then provided jail space based on the fact that they were, in fact, district court prisoners. And the indigent defense cost was absorbed by Multnomah County in providing indigent defense services. And all of this continued to run until January of 1983, when the state took this burden over from the counties because the counties could no longer afford to provide most of these services. These are core functions of our system of government, but they are not free and they are not without substantial expense, and so we now arrive at 2003 with the Circuit Court of Multnomah County handling everything from parking citations to aggravated murder in Multnomah County, and we try to do the best we can with all of that.
Additional cost to the rest of the state? Is there an offsetting benefit?
There's a tremendous offsetting benefit.
We get half of
all the parking citations, and we get half of all the traffic fines, and that is why we collect between $800 and $1 million more a month than it costs to run the court.
Might want it back. That has been floated up there, that they would take the Multnomah County Court back, and we would have a huge hit on the state general fund.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that is correct. The statutory prohibition against Multnomah County having a municipal court was designed to ensure that the then Multnomah County didn't lose the advantage it had gained by absorbing the City of Portland Municipal Court, and that statute's remained in place to this day.
Despite what Senator Devlin may say, that Washington County is the economic engine of the state, which he has claimed on numerous occasions. Go ahead, Senator Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, I actually wanted to make a statement totally unrelated. I wanted to apologize again to the Chief Justice. I don't normally do this about being out, but this is not great timing to have your budget up for future. The Senate, I don't know what the House has, but the Senate has like 11 business days left for initial consideration of Senate measures. So if you don't get it considered in the next 11 days, business days, you're not going to get it considered at all. We just hope that the House date for consideration of Senate measures, the Senate date for is April 11th for initial consideration. We hope that the House's date isn't April 10th for consideration.
Despite the fact that we have double the amount of members. Ours is the April.
But I would really like to be here, but I'm being pulled left and right.
We have 10 minutes left. We have information technology. So if you want to come up, Carl and Jim and Doug. We should just keep you up here, Doug.
Chair Patridge, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Carl Ward. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the Judicial Department. I'll let my colleagues introduce themselves.
Jim Adams, Court Administrator, Jackson County.
Doug Bray, Court Administrator for Multnomah County.
You're getting a handout one page long that is essentially what I'm going to say to you this afternoon. The mission critical applications that we run in the Judicial Department are the jury management system, the foster care review system, which was redone in the last biennium as a first phase of the part of the implementation for the Federal Adoption and Safe Families Act, the OGIN case management system, which people usually associate as the system for the trial courts, financial integrated accounting system, which is of which the ARMS system, the accounts receivable management system, is a component of that system. Additionally, there are numerous other applications and systems that support the work of virtually all of the judges and staff in the Judicial Department. There is much more that the Information Technology Division does that is essentially the equivalent of keeping the electricity on and the water flowing through the pipes that is not very visible and not very exciting until it doesn't work, and then it becomes your top priority. We additionally run a system that is connected to many of our other systems that we call the public access system, which provides access, public access by way of the internet to most of the city, state, and county criminal justice agencies in the state. Additionally, almost 600 mostly Oregon businesses access that system to have access to court financial and case information. Increasingly, we are providing self-help by way of the internet. Most court calendars today are available by way of the internet. Most family law forms are available by way of the internet. The Information Technology Division is really in the middle of implementing a strategic technology plan that we presented to the 70th Legislative Assembly. I hope I got that number right. It was 1999, I think. That plan included modernization of our mission-critical applications, implementation of the Adoption and Safe Families Act, which that was a federal act that changed the number and type of court reviews of out-of-home placement of children substantially, increased the number of reviews, completely changed the scheduling of those reviews from what they had been before. Development of appellate courts case management application, among several other sort of major envisioned applications in that strategic technology plan. In general, the plan was envisioned to improve the delivery of service from the courts and the criminal justice system as a whole. Technology plan staffing was phased in through December 2001. So for about 2 years, we recruited, hired, and trained staff. And in December of 2001, we were fully staffed for about a month. Following that, as we started to have budget reductions in the state, we've held vacancies. And even though the Judicial Department has protected our budget, we've reduced our budget a little over 11%, substantially less actually than the rest of the department. We're currently holding 6 vacancies in our department. So we sort of went up the scale to December 2001, and now we've started to sort of go down the scale in terms of resources and staffing. In the last biennium, we made some substantial modifications to the accounting system. We, as was mentioned earlier, we added the capability of sending delinquent accounts out to third-party collection agencies in addition to the Department of Revenue. We implemented Senate Bill 70 last session, Senate Bill 70, which was the addition of several collection fees to delinquent accounts. We continued implementation of a project called Uniform Criminal Judgment, which was sort of a leading edge component of upgrading of our case management system, which involved producing the criminal judgment in the courtroom at the time of sentencing. That's currently in production in 16 courts, and Lane County, Multnomah County, and Jackson County are all in the process of
Where are the other counties
implementing
not
that. It's just a matter of sort of resources and time to get that rolled out, Representative Patridge.
What's the time cost to roll it out, just besides staff training?
The true cost of rolling that system out is we have four people who go out in the trial court, so that's a sort of a dedicated cost for this project right now. They're not doing only that, but mostly that. For the trial courts, the cost is fairly substantial in terms of majorly changing the business practices in the court, in the courtroom, in sort of really major ways. Right now, the way a judgment happens in some courts is the district attorney essentially prepares the judgment, brings it to the court. These guys could actually speak to this better than I could, but after review by the court, the judge signs it. In some courts, the court prepares it. In any event, that traditionally that judgment document is prepared and signed days, weeks, or even months after sentencing takes place.
The capital needs of these local jurisdictions? I mean, my understanding is in the counties who've done this, there's been some efficiencies and cost savings that have shifted to the bottom line. And my question is, I guess, are there capital? Is it a training problem, a capital problem, combination thereof? And what's the? I just want to know what the barrier is to rolling it out.
Representative Patridge, members of the committee. I don't think there's really a barrier to rolling it out other than that it takes time. Courts have been enthusiastic about it. To the extent that they've been reluctant, it's simply that it's a big change that takes a lot of time, and you have to sort of find the time in your daily work to be able to take on a task like that. To some extent, it's taken this long because with four people going out into the courts to assist with that, you can really only do four or five or maybe six courts at once.
This has been piloted since 1999.
This has been underway for a long time.
Do we have an implementation schedule over what's going to happen during this biennium as to all the courts are going to roll over to it or not?
Representative Patridge, members of the committee, what I would have to say is with the staff that I currently have, we would certainly be substantially finished probably halfway through the next biennium.
But has every court requested it?
Has every court requested it? Representative Patridge, members of the committee, I think all of the courts are on board with this, yes. I can't say that I have every last one of them scheduled, but I think they're all on board.
I guess my issue is if we're going to continue to fund information technology, that I want to make sure the courts are utilizing it. So I'd like to know what your schedule looks like for implementation. You know, I understand that judges have their own peculiarities as to what they do or don't want to do, and that is substantially a barrier. But we all need to get on board on this, and so. I'd be interested to know what the implementation timeline looks like for you, and what it's going to take if we're to fund at the Chief Justice's budget levels. What's it going to look like, and how long is it going to take for us to roll out, and what, if any, cost savings we're going to accrue as a result? We've been dealing with this for 4 years. Now we're going into year five. So.
Representative Patridge, members of the committee, I have. Information about, you know, who's been installed and what our installation schedule is for the next 6 or 8 months, and I'll get that to you. And then there aren't a whole lot of courts left after that, so I will get that back to you. In addition to uniform criminal judgment, we developed and implemented phase one of Adoption Safe Families Act implementation. That is a multiple phase, multiple year project. Web court calendars are now available in 27 courts. beginning of last biennium, I think we only had that available in about a half a dozen courts. We are working with the appellate courts on an appellate court, actually right now a panel management system, but we're working with the appellate courts for a whole sort of case management system. Some OGIN maintenance is underway, and some additional mandatory maintenance to the financial system is underway. That sort of brings us to where we are today. Where we go in the future, to some extent, is, as with the rest of state governments, dependent on how our funding goes. In the future, immediate future, we were looking at electronic transfers of the Uniform Criminal Judgment to District Attorneys, Department of Corrections, and Defense Bar. Those are being emailed to some of those agencies now, but because of the volume, we'd like to set that up in an automated way. Scheduled hearing transfers to district attorneys is another data transfer that's been underway for a long time, but just takes resources to roll that out to the district attorneys. Enhancements to the public access system, future phases of the Adoption Safe Families Act, family court, judicial decision support have these projects have been placed on hold for the duration until we see whether we have the resources to continue on. In addition, next biennium, we have additional future phases of the accounting system that we need to work on, appellate court system, and for the case management system, probation violations, traffic dispositions, person-based views of the information in our case-based management system, and sort of a long list of additional functionality that the courts have wanted. That was the strategic plan. That was the view of make the courts a better place to come and get service. What we are doing right now is we're really at a point in time where, due to budget reductions, my steering committee is, and really the whole department is saying we need to look tactically at what we can do in the short term to save money, and are there things that we can do tactically to save money that will help us out of our current situation. So some of the strategic plan may get pushed out into the future or just put on hold indefinitely.
Out of time, I think, and we'll be back tomorrow. Any questions as the panel goes away? Okay, I just didn't want to lose everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks. We are in recess. We're adjourned until tomorrow, and we'll continue 55:23.